Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Lynn Nesner, registration 39209. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Juan Ruiz. I will be focusing on the first issue in the opening brief concerning the violation of Mr. Ruiz's right to counsel of choice. This is an issue where Mr. Ruiz was placed in a terrible dilemma through no fault of his own. The district court violated his right to choice of counsel in two primary ways. First, the court forced his retained counsel to withdraw, giving no deference to Mr. Ruiz's constitutional rights. Second, the court did not afford Mr. Ruiz adequate time to obtain new counsel. Thus, Mr. Ruiz was not able to go to trial with his chosen counsel, but rather he had to scramble to obtain some representation only weeks before trial. Because the issue is fact-specific, I'm going to lay out the relevant events and facts. Mr. Ruiz hired private counsel, Mr. Arthur Folsom, to represent him at the outset of the case. Mr. Ruiz's trial was originally set for the end of February 2008. In mid-February, defense counsel asked for a continuance. The prosecution did not have any objections, and the court granted the continuance, resetting the trial for the end of April. Mr. Ruiz raised his speedy trial rights, and the new speedy trial date was set at the end of August. In mid-April, defense counsel asked for a second continuance because he needed to undergo treatment related to his diabetes. Again, the prosecution did not object. However, when the parties appeared before the court on April 17th, the trial court insisted that Mr. Ruiz obtain substitute counsel. The court said that it would not wait for Mr. Folsom's medical issues to resolve themselves.
Counsel, excuse me, did the original counsel, I believe it was Mr. Folsom?
Yes.
Did he ever indicate a date certain by which he would be able to try the case?
No, nor did the court inquire as to when he would finish treatment.
Was there any, what basis did would the court have had to think that he would be available at any time in the foreseeable future?
When he requested the second continuance in April, he said that he needed to undergo treatment for 4 to 6 weeks, and he believed by June he would know better, he would know more about his medical condition in June. However, the court was impatient with his answer in April, and, you know, really emphasized that Mr. Ruiz needed to obtain substitute counsel. The court did move the trial to the end of June, June 23rd to be specific. But the court emphasized that it would not grant a continuance past that date and that Mr. Ruiz was in great peril. And that the case was going to be tried on June 23rd, regardless of Mr. Ruiz's circumstances. On May 9th, the parties returned for a substitution hearing, and at that point, the court allowed Mr. Folsom to withdraw, even though Mr. Ruiz did not have new counsel. Mr. Ruiz told the court that he and his wife had spoken to three lawyers, but they did not have money for a retainer, and the lawyers did not want to take the case given the proximity of the trial date.
Excuse me again, but he did attend eventually retain a lawyer about a month before trial, correct?
Yes, he did.
And
3 weeks before trial.
Is the complaint that, or is the argument that there wasn't sufficient time for that new counsel to prepare for trial, is that the complaint? Or is the complaint that there's somebody else that he would have located if he'd had an unlimited amount of time who he might have preferred?
The argument's twofold. First, that the court's insistence in April that he get new counsel was unreasonable, and because Mr. Folsom was his chosen counsel.
No, I understand.
And
that.
The second is that the court did not afford Mr. Ruiz adequate time to obtain a substitute counsel.
What I'm asking is, when you say he didn't have adequate time to obtain substitute counsel, is that because the counsel obtained did not have adequate time to prepare for trial, or is there some other reason?
It's because the court only allowed, the court insisted that they go to trial on June 23rd, a date that they did not actually go to trial on because the court then delayed it 2 days of its own scheduling issues. But the court only allowed Mr. Ruiz, I mean, less than 6 weeks to obtain counsel under circumstances where he had limited financial means, and he had to obtain a lawyer who would take a first-degree assault case to trial in 3 weeks. And many lawyers were not willing to do that. So,
but he did obtain counsel, correct?
Yes.
And that counsel appeared before the court twice before trial?
Yes.
And did not ask for a continuance?
No.
And stated on the first day of trial he was prepared for trial, right?
Yes. The court had made clear in May that, in April through May, that it would not grant any further continuances, that it would not wait.
Other than the statement that it might allow it to continue as of up to a month.
It said tentatively it would allow that time, but it said numerous times that it would not wait, that it was ready to go.
Okay, thanks.
Ms. Messner, you said that you thought the trial court judge was being unreasonable and in not granting another continuance to Mr. Folsom. Well, in your view, what should the test be that we should consider for trial judges to apply in determining whether to grant another continuance when a lawyer is experiencing medical problems?
I think a defendant has a fundamental right under the Sixth Amendment that's been recognized by the Colorado Supreme Court and U.S. Supreme Court to be represented by counsel of his choosing, the counsel that he believes to be best. And attorneys are not fungible.
Well, I understand that, but let's say that, just as a hypothetical, that the trial court kept granting continuance after continuance, and say there had been six continuances. At some point, do you think that the trial court judge would be justified in saying, okay, I've been very patient, but now it's time for you to find another lawyer to represent you?
I think the court has to balance the interests, that on the one hand you have, you know, the court's interest in judicial efficiency and getting the case to trial and controlling its docket, and on the other hand you have the defendant's constitutional rights. And so there needs to be adequate, like, findings and support in the record for when, you know, docket control overrides a constitutional right. Recently, a division of this court in People v. Brown addressed a similar issue, and they found structural error where a district court refused to grant a continuance so that the defendant could be represented by private counsel, his newly retained counsel. And the court found that
Brown, though, didn't the counsel say, I can't get ready in time for trial? And so, but the court nonetheless made the defendant go to trial without that counsel?
Yes.
And in this case, the new counsel didn't say that.
But the court still put Mr. Ruiz in a position where he had to obtain counsel under a really short window of time where he had limited financial means and many lawyers refused to take the case. So the quality of the lawyer that he obtained, I mean, it's questionable, but because this is structural error, it's well established that the defendant must have a reasonable opportunity to employ and consult with counsel. And here, the window of time that the court gave him to obtain the new counsel was not reasonable. It was, even if it's not reasonable. And I think, you know, the constitutional right is not absolute. The court may place limitations on it, but they can't be arbitrary. They have to be reasonable, and they have to give some deference to the defendant's choice that, you know, he retained a lawyer, and that's who he trusted, and he wasn't able to go to trial with that lawyer. And it would have been one thing if the court had inquired as to when Mr. Folsom could go to trial, or if the prosecution was making objections and saying, you know, this is going to be an inconvenience. But here there's nothing in the record to support the court's haste or why the court said, you know, I'm not going to grant any continuances. We're going to trial on the June 23rd. And the court didn't make any findings that Mr. Ruiz was trying to manipulate the system. There's no evidence that a later trial date would have inconvenienced or harmed any party. The court didn't, you know, say that it was backlogged or that it was unable to hold the trial, you know, months later. There's nothing to support its insistence and the bind that it put Mr. Ruiz in. And I don't think, because his counsel was acting under the court's direction or believed that the court had said, I'm not going to continue the case any further, that somehow waives this issue. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Crane, and I represent the people in this case. My attorney registration number is 37842. I want to apologize off the bat. I have a bit of a cold, and I'm going to do the best to keep my voice up and at a volume that's able to be understood. But this case comes down to abuse of discretion, and that's the main point that I emphasized in the answer brief, and that's the point on which this case should be resolved. The trial court, as the court's questions here have pointed out already, was faced with a situation in which a lawyer had come in twice, continuing a trial date, essentially on the eve of trial, once 4 days before trial, a second time, 10 or 11 days before trial. And what the court did was very reasonable. It was not arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. The court essentially said, okay, medical condition, we're continuing the first time, medical condition, we're continuing the second time. We're not going to do this again on the eve of trial. We're going to set a third trial date, and I need to know, Mr. Attorney, in three weeks, let me know. Figure out what you need to figure out, but let me know if you can go to trial. And if not, we have to get this case going, and we need to get a trial date certain on the calendar.
Mr. Crane, where does abuse of discretion end and structural error begin with regard to the question of the right to counsel?
I think it's a good question, Judge, and I don't know if I can delineate it any better than greater minds than I have attempted to and some of the opinions that have been discussed already and in the briefs. But obviously the case law recognizes that there's this tension between, you know, a court's need to control its docket and exercise the orderly administration of justice, and has to make sure certainly that a defendant can't be gaming the system and manipulating the judicial system, while at the same time a defendant has the right certainly to, if he has funding, retain the counsel of his choosing. This case this case does not present that close of a question to where that line needs to be teased out any further than it already has.
Well, that's not what your opposing counsel says. So I'm trying to find out from you what the dividing line is. Where do we say, no, this was within the trial court's discretion, it was okay, or the defendant, or conversely, the defendant was denied his right to counsel of choice? I mean, how do we decide which standard review to employ?
Well, in either case, we apply abuse of discretion first, right, before we get to structural error and the question of whether or not there's prejudice, or we have to find, even in any view, that there was an abuse of discretion before we can apply structural error or automatic reversal if we're going to do that.
But if you're talking about the right to counsel, if the defendant was denied his or her right to counsel, that would be a legal question subject to de novo review. Am I mistaken in that? Or are you saying that it's always an abuse of discretion threshold question?
I believe that's correct. And, you know, the Brown case has already been cited, a recent case out of this court. That's certainly the standard that was applied there. And the case that I cited was Maestas v. People, or People versus Maestas. It was actually a case, it dealt with some counsel of choice issues, but it actually, in that case, the question is whether or not a counsel was properly disqualified. The circumstances of that case required an abuse of discretion standard, and that's why I argued that it's the same type of issue here, where you have, what Brown says is the reason abuse of discretion applies is trial courts in these situations necessarily have to be balanced in competing factors. On the one hand, the defendant's right to choose his counsel if he can afford it. On the other hand, all these other factors that come into play, because the choice of counsel is not absolute. And that's what the case law says, that it yields to a lot of other considerations when they're sufficiently strong enough, and when the defendant's choice of counsel is not asserted strongly enough, or it's not made strongly enough, or it's not sufficiently weighty to outweigh the concerns of that I've already talked about.
But you're saying then if there was in fact an abuse of discretion, then the next step would be to say if there that it was structural error, and result in automatic reversal.
If we were determine first, then it's obviously our contention that it was not an abuse.
I understand that, of course.
Sure. If we were to arrive at that conclusion, I think the question then, the case law is fairly clear. If the abuse of discretion rises to the level of a denial of a choice of counsel, that is a structural error, because the choice of counsel is structural error. That's what the case law says. The point of my answer brief was, I think there's a basis on which we shouldn't apply automatic reversal. First of all, the defendant in a case like this needs to show somehow that he was harmed. Even if we're not going to argue about harm and we think that the harm is unquantifiable, at least in a case like this, the question that counsel of choice was before the trial court was not obvious. And that's another point of plain error. I mean, that's what plain means, is obvious. The trial court here was presented with a question concerning continuances, its docket, and the fact that here defense counsel had shown up twice and continued and still couldn't guarantee when he could ever go to trial. So I think it's a problem. It essentially comes down to sandbagging, because I don't think it's fair for a defendant to come later on appeal and say, oh, well, wait a minute, that was actually my counsel of choice, and this was this huge constitutional issue at stake, and the trial court should have just recognized that on its own, even though I never objected, my new counsel never objected. I never said, Judge, I really wanted that first lawyer. I never mentioned choice of counsel, the Sixth Amendment, or even the Constitution. So maybe my discussion about why automatic reversal is inappropriate in a case like this goes more towards obviousness.
Counsel, excuse me for interrupting, but
absolutely, Judge.
The defendant hired this lawyer apparently at a time when there was no particular time crunch. Can't we assume that was his lawyer choice, since he, you know, of all the lawyers there were to hire, he hired that particular lawyer, and his lawyer was seeking continuances on his behalf, and he was waiving his speedy trial rights. Isn't that a pretty strong indication that was his counsel of choice?
Well, his lawyer, I'm not sure to what degree he was seeking continuances. He certainly didn't make it clear by the end of this time when the court was saying, I have to have a date certain on which you can try a case. He didn't say, you know, Judge, I've got to stop right here and say, you know what, 30 days out from this trial date that you're going to set, you know, the final trial date that the court set, I can't guarantee I can do the trial date you said, but I can guarantee, you know, XYZ dates or something. Defense counsel essentially said, okay, Judge, I can't guarantee that date, and I can't do the trial on half days like you're offering for right now. I guess I have to withdraw from the case. That, to me, is not a significant enough assertion of the choice of counsel to put the trial court on notice that it needs to address this particular issue.
Well, saying that the defendant himself needed to stand up and say, wait a minute, Judge, don't go any further. This is the guy I really want. I need to have this lawyer. Is that what you're saying? He had that burden to do that?
There needed to be something. In this case, there was nothing. Maybe it needs to be very subtle. I understand your question as acknowledging, well, isn't it enough that he actually just hired this lawyer to begin with, and the lawyer showed up in court? All the case law that I've looked at has something much more specific, where I think in Gonzalez-Lopez, the Supreme Court case in 06, the lawyer kept trying to enter on the case, and the trial court kept saying, no, 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 you can't enter because you're, he wanted to enter pro hoc vice. In Brown, Brown demonstrates, I mean, it went to the essence of the choice of counsel, because the defendant, up until the time at which a continuance was sought, had a public defender, a state-appointed lawyer. Then 2 weeks before trial, he says, Judge, I finally got the funds together. I've got a private lawyer. I want to choose an attorney now. And the trial court said, no, I think the public defender will do a good job. And even though the defendant hadn't requested any continuances before that, or at least none were attributable to him, according to the trial court said, no, you can't have an attorney of your choosing, even though you've hired one. And he's here in court saying, Judge, defendant wishes to hire private counsel, and I'm ready to jump into this case. I've ordered discovery. So those are the situations that I read in the other case law that, to me, are quite distinguishable from what we have here, where there was very little indication, if any, that this was a choice of counsel issue facing the court. With regards to the trial court's strong language, I at least want to make a note that, admittedly, the trial court used some strong language here, saying, you know, I'm not going to continue this anymore. We've got to go to trial. I've got to get this case tried. Mr. Ruiz, you're the one who's in peril here. You've got to get a lawyer. I want to point out the trial court never actually made the defendant go to trial pro se. The trial court did not force a lawyer on the defendant that he didn't want. The trial court actually didn't even deny a continuance by a new lawyer that got on the case, because none was ever requested. So what I think we're actually looking at here is, it's pretty common. This is, trial courts have to use strong language like this, and frequently do, to get defendants to act and go ahead and go out and get a lawyer, because it's common that a defendant will keep showing up at the trial court and saying, I haven't gotten a lawyer yet. I'm trying to get the funds together. I thought that was going to come through last time, but it didn't quite come through. And so I think that's what we're looking at with the trial court's strong language. The court didn't actually do something like make the defendant go to trial pro se against his will, or deny further continuances to a new attorney. If the court has no further questions, I will simply ask that the case be affirmed, and I thank the court for its time.
Regarding the standard review, I think whether Mr. Ruiz's constitutional rights were violated is a legal question subject to de novo review. And if this court finds a violation of his right to a choice of counsel, it is structural error requiring reversal without any showing of harm or prejudice. And if this court were to apply an abuse of discretion standard, it would still warrant reversal because the court's actions were unfair and arbitrary in the manner in which it limited Mr. Ruiz's right to choose his counsel, you know, first by disqualifying his counsel and then by limiting the time. And I don't think there's any issue of sandbagging. If anything, the court sandbagged the defendant. The defendant was not expecting his lawyer to withdraw and could not control his lawyer's medical issues, and yet Mr. Reeves had to find a new lawyer in a month's time before trial. And the court did very much dictate what kind of lawyer he could get by giving such limited time frames and being unwilling, for the most part, to work with his new counsel. And the court threatened Mr. Ruiz on May 12th that if he did not find a new counsel, he would have to proceed without counsel. So I think the only reason why the court didn't make Mr. Ruiz go to trial pro se is because Mr. Ruiz was able to find someone very last minute, but the court very much threatened that Mr. Ruiz would have to go to trial pro se. And at no point did the court advise him of any of his rights. And so in terms of several hearings where he appeared pro se, to the extent that he could advise the court that, I mean, he was pro se, he did protest that he didn't have money and he was having trouble. And I don't think this was him trying to delay the court or not putting in diligent efforts, because at every turn he told the court that he had called all the lawyers or called half the lawyers on the low pay list, and that he had met with lawyers and that he couldn't afford them. And he had already paid a lawyer at the beginning. And through no fault of his own, he lost that lawyer. And there was not giving an adequate time period to obtain, you know, an equal counsel. And this amounts to structural error without any showing of harm. So accordingly, we would ask this court to reverse Mr. Ruiz's conviction and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Both counsel for your arguments. We appreciate them. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in your in